enthusiasts, and welcome to Season 3 of Style Points. I'm not sure what that means, other than this being the third year of me recording the podcast. However, I feel that calling it a season lends the podcast a certain sense of gravitas. I'm your host, John Crow. Today, we're going to discuss long-distance running and its physiologic implications for anesthesiology with CRNA Jordan Crouch. Before I let him run away with things, though, I'm going to hand it over to my co-host, Nate Moore, to introduce this month's RSI, which of course stands for Resident Selected Information.
Thank you, John. I get to introduce Dr. Wes Young, formerly a PA working in a cardiac ICU before he went to med school and joined us in anesthesia, making him especially qualified to give his RSI on hemodynamic management. We think his insights are so valuable that the chair of our department, Dr. Stuart Birch, is currently sitting stool in his spine case so that Wes can be with us. Welcome, Wes.
Hello, my name is Wesley Young. I'm one of the CA1s at the University of Cincinnati, and I'm going to talk to you about pressors in the operating room, their hemodynamic effects, and common uses. But before diving into the drugs and their mechanism of action, I think it's important to review some cardiovascular physiology. Our oxygen delivery system can be broken down into our macrocirculation, which we often refer to as like blood pressure, heart rate, cardiac output, and SVR. But then we also have the microcirculation, which represents the flow required to deliver adequate amounts of oxygen to a particular organ. And this is what we really care about. Some organs are great at autoregulation, meaning that they can maintain flow over a wide range of blood pressures, and others struggle a little bit in the department, kind of like the kidneys. But they all, to a certain extent, have the ability to have their arterioles vasodilate or vasoconstrict, depending on local mediators like PO2, potassium, lactic acid, etc., in order to regulate the flow. So from a big picture, our body creates a pressure gradient using cardiac output and changes in the resistance provided by arterioles to increase or decrease flow to our organs, which means we can quickly shift blood to our quadriceps when running a marathon or our intestines when eating a delicious burger. The problem is that in the OR, we have departed from normal physiology and thrown in drugs that cause venous and arterial dilation, patients bleed, they have inappropriate inflammatory cascades, and we often switch them from negative pressure to positive pressure ventilation. One last thing, hypotension is the primary reason for using vasopressors, but we can't forget that even though our blood pressure is the driving factor for flow, it's generated through cardiac output and systemic vascular resistance, either of which could be the problem. The primary receptors that mediate an increase in blood pressure are typically the alpha-1 adrenergic receptor. We also have our V1 receptor, and then we also have the beta-1 adrenergic receptor that increases cardiac output and heart rates. The first vasopressor that we oftentimes use in the operating room is called norepinephrine. It's a potent agonist of the alpha-1 adrenergic receptor, and that causes vasoconstriction. And then there's also some modest beta-1 adrenergic activity, which helps maintain cardiac output and doesn't have much effect on the heart rate. We typically give this in bolus dosing of around 8 to 16 mics. Phenylephrine, on the other hand, is a selective alpha-1 adrenergic agonist. It particularly leads to arterial and venous vasoconstriction and has very little effect on cardiac output. We typically give bolus dose of around 100 mics. Ephedrine acts a little bit differently. It indirectly stimulates the release of endogenous norepinephrine and has some direct effect by binding to alpha-1 and beta-1 receptors, but that effect isn't as pronounced. You can see an increase in heart rate and some cardiac output, as well as your increase in vascular tone. We can give it intravenously through bolus dosing around 5 to 10 milligrams, and then we can also use it as IM injection around 25 milligrams. Epinephrine is a non-selective adrenergic agonist. At low doses, it causes a beta-1 effect, mostly by increasing heart rate and contractility, and at higher doses, it leads to alpha-1 vasoconstriction. We typically give bolus doses around 10 mics. Dopamine is kind of a dirty drug that we used to use back in the day, but it causes so many like tachyarrhythmias that we've kind of fallen out of favor. Vasopressor, on the other hand, is a non-catecholamine vasopressor that acts on the V1 receptor on vascular smooth muscle, and that causes vasoconstriction that way. We usually give it in, one to two units at a time. So as a general rule, norepinephrine is the most balanced vasopressor that generates a nice rise in blood pressure without sacrificing too much on your cardiac output. It's usually the first line pressor for the majority of the shock states, and you can rarely go wrong by giving norepinephrine. Phenylephrine is a great drug. We've been giving it for years in the operating room. It's a good option for the majority of our hypotension that's related to anesthesia. You know, a lot of our drugs cause low SVR or maybe decreased venous tone as well, and that can be quickly counteracted by the phenylephrine's like pure alpha 1 agonism. So we'll see a rise in SVR that way. But then you also have some venous vasoconstriction, which kind of increases venous return. We have to be careful with phenylephrine, though. It does have a reflexive bradycardia that we can see pretty profoundly in the operating room. The increase in SVR also can decrease cardiac output. So it's, you know, something to be avoided in patients who have, you know, heart failure or severe pulmonary hypertension. Epinephrine, we use in the operating room as well. It increases more of your cardiac output as well as SVR. And you'll notice a nice rise in your heart rate when you use it in the operating room. You should be careful by not giving it too much because it does cause some tachyarrhythmias. Vasopressin used to be a drug that we use in our ACLS algorithm all the time. It's a useful adjunct to increase vascular tone. And there is a theoretical benefit that we can increase SVR without really affecting your pulmonary vascular resistance. And so sometimes we'll try and use vasopressin more in patients who have severe pulmonary hypertension as opposed to other pressors. And then finally, we have ephedrine. And like we said earlier, this is the one that mostly relies on endogenous catecholamines. And it can be given IM, which gives it kind of a longer acting range. And it's useful in our OB population, who oftentimes have, you know, hypotension from either the epidural, you know, causing that sympathectomy. And it will slowly wear off as the epidural wears off as well. It's typically not recommended in patients who are critically ill because they likely have depleted catecholamine stores and therefore wouldn't have much effect on their blood pressure. I hope this quick review on vasopressors was helpful, and hopefully next time in the operating room, you can choose the best drug for your patient.
My athletics started in football, then to a 5K, then to Ironman, then to endurance running. So...
I feel like 5K to Ironman is that's maybe a little bit of a jump there.
It was a progressive process, but yeah,
it's kind of like a draw the rest of the owl situation.
Yeah.
Okay, Jordan, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Absolutely. Jordan, before we get started, I'd love it if you'd tell our audience a little bit about yourself and your training. All that sort of thing.
I've been a nurse anesthetist for 5 years. I trained at UC, and my athletics background is I played football for a while, and after football, really wanted to stay in shape and keep exercising, but wasn't really interested in going to the gym anymore. And I think football kind of made weightlifting feel like a job, and for whatever reason I just kind of got burnt out on that, and I think you see that both ways. Some runners gravitate towards weightlifting after, you know, after their collegiate careers, but so I took up running, and I started off with a 5K and then gradually kept growing my running volume to some longer endurance, and then eventually into Ironman distance.
What is Ironman distance?
Ironman distance, it's like 140, like 0.6 miles, and it involves a 2.4-mile swim, 112-mile bike ride, and then a marathon. So it's an all-day event, and it's a lot of endurance, and I really like that, but... I think there's parts of Ironman that you gravitate towards more, like you really like swimming or you really like biking or you really like running. And I really fell in love with the running part of it the most. So I tended to gravitate towards that afterwards.
One of the reasons why I wanted to have you on the podcast is because I've heard you talk about your running experience before, and I found it super interesting. You have run, I think, probably more distance than maybe the rest of the department combined, I would say. Is there anyone else in the department that runs anywhere close to as much as you?
That's a good question. I don't know. I have heard there might be somebody who's trying to do like all the marathons in all the states or something, or all the big marathons. I'm not sure, but every now and then people, you know, when they hear you run, they'll like mention somebody else that also runs, and it's hard to keep them all straight. But yeah, it's a lot of running. It's a lot of miles. So I think the my weekly volume, I try to keep around 50 to 70 miles a week at least. And then you kind of go up or down from there, depending on, you know, races or what you have going on.
Excellent. So how do you fit in 50 to 70 miles per week? How does that look in your life?
Well, I'm very lucky that I live close enough that I can run to work. So, you know, that's about 6 miles there.
See, that's just right out for me, because if you said the same for me, if I said I live 6 miles from work, that would exclude me from running from work.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean, so it actually, it's only, so it's 6 miles total, but it's like three here, three home.
Okay.
Yeah.
So that's a little bit.
It's not as much. Insane. Yeah. But I think that that's easy because, you know, after work or before work, if you want to add a little distance, you know, it's very easy to just keep going and get like the training plan done or whatever you have for that day. And it's honestly, it's a great stress relief after work to, you know, be able to go outside and move around. You kind of learn to value the nice weather, you know, after you have some bad weather. So it works out really well for me. I know not everybody has that luxury, you know, if you live, you know, 10, 15 miles out, but finding a way to make it work is key.
Well, let me back up for a second. I want to ask the same question that I like to ask everybody. If you could invite anyone over in the world for dinner, could be somebody from the past or even from fiction, who would you invite over?
That's a good question. I think right now, just on top of my mind, is this character called, his name's Gary Cantrell, and he goes by the alias Lazarus Lake. He's recently featured in a book I'm reading. It just came out. It's a really good book, but the book's called The Endurance Artist. And Gary Cantrell, he's credited for creating a lot of the race formats in endurance running, and he's designed a lot of the racing styles that we use in ultra running, including the backyard race. It's a last man standing race where you will run 4.1 miles every hour on the hour until there's one person left standing. So he has these really unorthodox or unique racing designs. And he also is the guy behind the Barkley Marathons. And the Barkley Marathons have a pretty famous documentary about them that made it really popular. But just to give you an idea, the race is so difficult. Like, very few people have ever finished it. I think it's been going, you know, not really sure on the exact year, but around the 1980s, it's been going on like that long. And, you know, there's only been a handful of people that's ever successfully completed it. So he really threads the needle on making a race that's just difficult that it's possible to do, but like very few people can actually do it. And I think it's interesting. The book actually made him even more interesting to me because you learn a lot more about him. And now I have more questions or more things I want to like ask him if I could. So that's who I'd pick to have dinner with if I could.
I don't know if that person would want to have dinner. They'd want to maybe go on a jog with
you. Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Okay. You have sort of a unique perspective as both a marathon, ultra marathon runner, really, and as a practitioner of anesthesiology. Tell me about how those things intersect. How does it influence how you think about endurance and physiology when you're thinking about your training as a CRNA and how it applies to running these enormous distances?
I think the right amount of training and knowledge about the body allows people to go a lot farther than what they think is possible. And I guess that kind of comes across in anesthesia in the sense that, you know, the body is not really a machine. Like, you know, a lot of people think that you're going to wear your joints out. But the thing with, you know, machines is that they can't heal themselves or they can't really adapt, you know? So you know, if you need new car tires, you just go buy new car tires. They don't really heal themselves, or they don't really adjust to the amount you're driving. So one of the things, you know, from the healthcare background or from anesthesia is that our bodies are way more incredible than, you know, what we give them credit for. And they're unique to machines in the sense that, you know, you can train and build up your physiology and with through, like, you know, consistent training, you can really allow yourself to go farther than what you think is possible.
That's really interesting. I think that in anesthesia a lot, we see people that are what we would consider to be surprisingly alive, who are kind of pushing the limits of human physiology, less because they're healthy, but more that they are dramatically unhealthy, right? So we see people who are just clinging to life with an extremely low ejection fraction or maybe an extremely high BMI, things like that. But you're talking about pushing it the other direction, where you're so healthy that you can overcome some of these other things. Is that sort of what you were saying?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I think that, you know, the biggest thing that I notice in ultra running is it'll show you really quickly is consistency. You know, being consistent is what allows for those adaptive changes. And it's evident just in a personal level, but also just through a lot of the training plans you see. One of the benefits, you know, honestly, going back to the run commuting is some would argue that doing a double like exercise during the day, like two runs a day instead of like one long run, is that you're actually activating a lot of those physiological responses. You're activating those twice. So rather than just running once and kind of turning everything off or on and then shutting it all back off again in terms of your exercise, doing that more frequently could be beneficial. So I think the consistency of, if I work, you know, a 12-hour shift, I'm kind of like running every 12 hours, you know, if I'm running home and then running to work and then adding some. So it really becomes like interwoven into your life, and it becomes second nature, almost like climbing a flight of stairs or like walking into work. So
a lot of people are really interested in biofeedback, and people like myself, I wear my Apple Watch, or you've got Oura rings or all these sort of things that help you measure different physiologic parameters. And that's sort of what we do in anesthesia as well. Is that something that you like to take a close look at when you're doing your runs, is your heart rate variability and all those sorts of parameters?
Yeah, I do. I'm actually, as we sit here, I have two watches on. So that's kind of...
I'm just noticing you have two watches.
Yeah, that's kind of a leading question, I think. But yeah, it's like, you know, I do have two watches on. So I wear the Apple Watch while I'm at work. It connects nicely to the iPhone and messages, but I like to wear the running watch at the same time because it's tracking my recovery and a lot of the other health metrics that you get from wearing it for extended periods of time, like when you sleep or while you're moving or at rest throughout the day. So even though I'm not exercising, it's still collecting some data that gives me information on my recovery.
How do you track your recovery? That's really interesting.
Yeah, it's mostly like heart rate variability is a common tool. And these things fall in and out of favor all the time. But I mostly like to do like the sleep score. And, you know, I like to trend these things because I think that, you know, like in anesthesia, trending is always a little bit more evident than just any single number by itself. So I kind of just hop on the trends of heart rate variability, looking at my resting heart rate, and I can really tell, like for instance, yesterday I ran 20 miles yesterday. And this morning on my way to work, as I ran in here for this podcast, my heart rate was quite a bit higher. And that just kind of shows that I had a big effort yesterday. So you can kind of tell, you know, like based on how your heart rate responds from the previous day, how difficult that exercise was for you. The issue with heart rate specifically is that it's not, as much as we love numbers in anesthesia, it's not always the greatest insight into your efforts.
Why not?
Well, I think it's usually, it can be very jumpy and it can be affected by a lot of things. And again, in anesthesia, that's one of the things we notice is that when we like a number, you can realize that that number can be affected by, you know, surgical stimulation. It can be affected by epinephrine injection. It can be affected by all kinds of different things. So depending on what's happening, you know, there's a number of explanations for it. So a lot of people like to lean towards this scale that they create called the rate of perceived exertion. And it's a lot of times it's abbreviated RPE. So using the rate of perceived exertion, you kind of come up with a scale in your own mind and you give yourself a score, like how difficult is this run for me right now?
Is that what pops up on my Apple Watch after I work out and it says, how difficult do you think that this was?
Yeah, that's exactly it. Yeah. It's okay. Kind of getting that in your mind. So it's able to maybe help you plan your training from there. So if that workout was really difficult, it might suggest an easier exercise the next day. But it's good to kind of be in tune with that. A lot of times, you know, the biggest thing that I think it happens is as an ultra runner, if you're really good and consistent in your training, the thing that tends to throw a wrench in the works is when you have to start tapering to go into a race, because that's when your consistency fluctuates a lot. And by tapering, I mean you start to decrease your weekly miles and you kind of rest yourself leading up to a big event. That big event, when it starts, sometimes because of the rest you've taken, your heart rate is like all over the place. It'll shoot way up and you're not even running that hard, but your heart rate's really high. It'll also be very erratic. So if you stop, it'll come way back down. And then if you start again, it'll shoot back up. Or if you start going up hilly terrains. So that's where the rate of perceived exertion comes in, because a lot of times you won't feel like you're working very hard at all. It's really just a physiological adjustment to maybe drinking a ton of fluids, eating a huge meal the day before, and also just taking that week off. It just, your body's kind of getting set back into what you're about to do. And it could also just be race anxiety, you know?
So what is your resting heart rate?
My resting heart rate. So when I'm at sleep, it's occasionally dipped into the 30s, which people love to hear about. You know, they like to think that, you know, my heart's beating at like once every 2 seconds. You know, I don't know. It's some people that causes anxiety, but yeah, it's most of the time it's in the 40s or 50s, you know. I would say if you were to look at your resting heart rate, like if you're like throughout the day, if you're sitting, it trends more towards like the mid to high 50s.
So a lot of people, when they see a heart rate of 50 on an anesthesia monitor, start to feel a little bit anxious because they think, oh no, the heart's slowing down and I must give glycopyrrolate to speed the heart rate back up. And what I will typically tell, you know, the newer practitioners who might want to treat a heart rate of 49 or 50 is I will point to my heart rate trend on my watch and say, well, my heart rate was 48 last night while I was sleeping. Please don't sneak into my house and give me glycopyrrolate. I don't need that to keep me alive.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah. They are asleep. Yeah. And a lot of times when we're noticing that, it's, you know, in this phase between like after we've put them to sleep and before the surgery starts, they're truly just laying there, right? Like they're not even having surgery yet.
Their rate of perceived exertion is very low.
Yeah. Very, very low. It's like they're in the deepest sleep they've ever been in, technically, you know? So yeah. That is a very interesting point, you know, and I try to remind myself of that too, because it's very different when you see things like that and you cycle a blood pressure and you go, okay, it's asymptomatic bradycardia. You know, they're totally fine. There's no reason to really be that worried about this, you know?
So when you do endurance training, it changes your heart rate and your stroke volume, things like that. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. So what you'll generally see as you start to exercise is, you know, they always talk about this left ventricle dilation that you get, and you get like a slightly increased amount of muscle on your left ventricle that will, you know, increase your stroke volume to help you meet the demands that your body's asking for. And I think, you know, that's why the consistency is so important. You have to activate these things very consistently over a long period of time. to get all the adaptions that you're looking for to reach your potential. And the heart rate for me, with consistency, and, you know, it wasn't with like very hard runs all the time or anything, you know, extra crazy. It was really just getting outside and moving consistently. My heart rate started to trend down, where I noticed, you know, after a couple weeks or months at the same running pace, my heart rate was much, much lower and much more comfortable. I think a lot of people start off running too hard or too fast for themselves. And I learned early on that every training session doesn't have to be like the hardest training session you've ever done. So I definitely started off as like a, they call it like, you know, the workout hero or the training hero, where you're like trying to like break records in your training every day. And a lot of that's just carryover from my football experience, where, you know, it might be motivational to do that if you're like lifting weights and you're really trying to, you know, throw heavy weight around and things like that. But I think for running, it's really just about like a consistency that you can maintain and sustain. And going too hard every day is not sustainable. It's just, it's going to lead to injury and some, you know, other complications and also burnout.
Are you shooting for a particular heart rate when you're running?
Yeah, for me, everybody has a little bit different. Like you can calculate, there's ways to calculating your heart rate zones. You know, the oldest one that we hear about is 220 minus your age. And you can kind of calculate it from, instead of the generic 220, you can kind of calculate it from a maximum heart rate, where you give your hardest effort, see how high your, you know, heart rate will get, and then kind of calculate some heart rate zones from there. It gets a little bit more complicated because with your training, you can actually dilate out these heart rate zones. Heart rate zones being like zone one would be, you know, like you're almost at rest or not really doing like very difficult activity at all. And zone two would be like a very comfortable, slightly elevated heart rate. So for me, I think it's around like 120 to 140. But you can actually extend these out so that they're wider to some extent, you know, depending on how your training is focused. So, you know, track athletes might have a very like wider upper range, or a very like, you know, steep upper range, where they can go into like very high heart rates because that's what they're pushing a lot of the time.
So when you're prepping for a really long run, it strikes me as some of the same prep that we would do for a really long anesthetic. There's things that you have to plan on in terms of hydration and sodium and all those sorts of things. Can you talk a little bit about the physiology of what it takes to plan for a really long run and what you do to prepare?
Yeah, I think that is something that is kind of overlaps a lot with ultra running, is like the planning component. It's tough because as the runner, and you're the only one that's being affected by your own decisions. So it's very easy just to go out the door without doing the planning you need to do. But you learn quickly that it's important to take the second to think, like, do I need gloves before I do this? Because, you know, cold hands can really just kind of ruin the whole run if your hands are cold the whole time. But yeah, you know, there are a lot of things. I basically, for myself personally, I'll take, you know, maybe some electrolyte drink with me. If not, then I kind of just rely on gas stations, which I think is kind of fun. Like you just run to like some unknown area that you haven't been to before, haven't been to in a long time, and pop into a gas station, get a snack, get a drink, and then you just kind of keep the run going. I usually do that if I'm doing like 20 plus miles. I'll do that around like mile 13. And I'll grab a drink, grab some food, and then just go back out and finish the next, you know, 7+ miles. The nice thing about that as well is that it kind of is a little bit of a stomach training, and it's very similar to a race, in which as I'm running, I will, you know, stop and get all this food and, you know, eat maybe like a snack and then drink a bunch of fluid and then start running again. And that's kind of very similar to like a race, where you might come up to an aid station, you're going to eat and drink a lot, and then you're going to start running again. And it kind of helps your body get used to that feeling.
If you're running one of your big 100-mile races or something like that, How much fluid do you need to support yourself in that sort of environment? Is it just purely based on thirst, or is there calculations that you have to do? How does that work?
Yeah, I kind of wish it was purely based on thirst, because there would be a lot less calculation needed. But unfortunately, I think when you're setting a goal, you know, goal-based fluid replacement, you know, when you're setting a goal to it, that's when it kind of becomes dangerous, because you can override a lot of those mechanisms, because, you know, you've calculated that you do, in fact, need a certain amount. And you're going to override, like, I'm not going to wait till I'm thirsty. It's in ultra running, it may be too late, you know, to start eating when you're hungry. Like, it's really hard to meet the demands, you know, once you're already getting like signals really firing that, oh, you're thirsty, you need water. And it's like, it's hard to replenish and keep it going for an extended period of time. It might not be a bad option to drink to thirst in a shorter event, like a 5K or even like a marathon. But I think
a shorter event, like a marathon.
Yeah, shorter, like a marathon. Just because,
quote you on that. That's
yeah, I think because, you know, the consequences, marathons can be long, you know, depending on the speed and things like that. The consequences don't play out over the entire night, you know, like in a 24-hour race. If you make a mistake, you have to deal with the consequences until like from 7 p.m. to 7 a.m. So it can be a long haul. But, you know, back to the question about the electrolyte goals and then the fluid replacement. So I tend to, the best way to kind of come up with a plan for fluid replacement that I've come across is you weigh yourself before an exercise, with, you know, without clothes or anything as a variable. You go out into the heat and run for about an hour and come back and weigh yourself again. That will essentially... The only thing that will be different there is that the amount that you sweated is gone. So any kind of sweat loss is out of the equation now, and you'll come up with a weight difference. You'll convert that to liters in terms of water, and your goal would be to replace 90 to 95% of that. So if you lost, you know, like 2 liters of sweat in an hour in like a very hot condition, that's kind of on the upper end of the sweat loss. But if you were to do that, you would aim for, you know, like 1.8 liters of replacement. And then...
Is that just water that you're replacing?
Yeah. So in this equation, it's you kind of just figure out the water component. So it'd be like 1.8 liters. And the most important part of this is that the amount of electrolytes you replace is a ratio. So you don't really want to like pick like an electrolyte like and think, I'm going to take 500 milligrams of sodium every hour. That's like not what you want to do. You always want to replace electrolytes as a ratio to water, because as your water intake changes, then your electrolyte intake will change. To give you an example, one of my races, I had a very difficult time with electrolytes. My goal was to kind of just drink this amount of water, take this amount of electrolytes every hour. What I ended up finding out was that I had severely low sodium at one point, because I had taken in about like 3 gallons of water and very, very little electrolyte, because the hourly intake electrolytes I had calculated seemed okay until you add in the 3 gallons of water. It was very imbalanced, you know, it was very water heavy. So I kind of went through the cascade of every symptom of low sodium that you could have, you know.
Let's go over hyponatremia. Let's go back to internal medicine days.
Yeah. Yeah. So step by step, you know, I didn't really notice the first couple signs of, you know, it was hard. It eventually became hard to want to take in anything. So I started having lack of thirst, and then kind of lethargic a little bit. And I felt like my performance was lacking, like in terms of like the run, and I was having a hard time like running. And that's one of the first things you'll see with dehydration, in a sense, is that you're having a difficulty like maintaining the performance you were before. But eventually it got to the point that I was kind of confused and a little bit delirious. But again, you're running a race, that the sun's setting, it's starting to get dark outside. So you're thinking like, you know, it's just all part of the race. What I ended up realizing as things progressed down were that I began to lose fine motor function, which is one of the very final signs of hyponatremia. So, yeah.
Talk about what that means. What did you notice?
Yeah, I, again, this was all of these things that I think at the time I wasn't the best like person to step back and analyze this at the time, because I was in fact the person who was being affected by it. But I remember as the sun went down, I felt like my hands were cold. And in reality, it was just that they weren't working because of hyponatremia. Because I think it was like 78 degrees outside. I remember I was having a hard time like turning my headlight on, things like that. And I felt like I needed gloves, you know, even though it was 78 degrees out. You know, I couldn't put the pieces together. I wasn't the best, at the time, I wasn't the best person to help myself. But thankfully the crew that I had, you know, in my last ounce of self-preservation, they gave me a sodium tablet. And even though I was being pretty uncooperative at the time, I guess, I think they were able to get me to take this sodium tablet. And I kind of laid down for a second and eventually came to and felt 100 times better just from like getting sodium in my system. So, you know, you live and you learn. And that's something like I didn't always try to connect dots, you know, from my anesthesia experience, but you know, that, you know, these ratios that we use in terms of fluid replacement, like having a balanced crystalloid solution, you know, in a sense, that's kind of what you need to do for fluid replacement. Another area this came up in is we did the analysis on whole blood replacement, you know, rather than reconstituting whole blood, you know, making whole blood through multiple units of packed reds and FFP and cryo and all these components, we were trialing this whole blood and traumas. And it's very similar to that. It's like it's much easier to do to like the, you know, like solution that's like a, you know, electrolyte drink or electrolyte mix versus like I'm going to drink a bunch of water and then I'm going to take a bunch of sodium and then I'm going to drink a bunch more water and then I'm going to take a bunch of sodium. It's like, you know, having a more stable, smooth hydration plan is much, much easier to maintain and easier to control.
So some of the different races that you've run or been adjacent to deal with some pretty extreme temperatures too, right? Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. So I, you know, the crazy thing about, you know, performing outside is temperature starts to affect you. And this is from, you know, research, but the heat in particular, heat starts to affect you at as little as 45 degrees Fahrenheit. So if it's over 45, you're dealing with heat. And even though that's typically a cold temperature, that's where it begins to affect your performance. So, heat training has become really popular lately. It's shown to like increase red blood cell mass and kind of help you adapt to oxygen carrying capacity and heat during your exercise or during your races. So one of the races I was a part of was one of the hardest ultramarathons in the world. It's called the Badwater 135. I was able to go out and crew and pace my friend Harvey Lewis. He was doing it for the 14th time, which is absolutely incredible to think. You know, somebody's done that race, you know, 14 times. He, you know, he's very skilled and talented. And we went out there this past summer. And again, of course, it's in Death Valley. The race is in the summer, so they really lean into the heat component of this race.
How hot is it there when the race is going on?
Yeah, so there's nobody ever really confirms anything, but there's rumors that it's the 135 miles and it's the Badwater 135 because it's been 135 degrees out there before. So there's like some kind of like link to that. I think when we were out there, it was a chilly year, you know, it was kind of cool that year and it was like 120. So, you know, so not too hot, you know, just 120 degrees.
Did you wear a jacket?
Yeah, I wore a jacket. and I wore gloves also. No, the interesting thing, so the heat in Death Valley, a lot of people were saying that, they're like, oh, well, Death Valley, it's a dry heat. And I always, before this was leading up to the race, and I kept thinking, yeah, it's dry heat, but it's still the fuel like temperature is still 125, you know, like it's still like, if it's 125 degrees, it's 125 degrees.
That's something I can set my oven to.
Yeah, exactly. So yeah, it certainly was hot, but I can give a testament to the heat training. I think that the sauna really helped. And again, it's with sauna specifically, the sauna training plan, they actually had one from the race. You know, it's the first race I've ever been a part of that had requirements for crews and pacers, where they actually sent us a guide and kind of showed us the how to, you know, prepare yourself for the heat out there. As hard as the race is, they have a really good safety record, and they're really well organized and making sure everybody is safe during the event. And the like ultra running, the sauna plan is mostly about consistency. It's about exposing yourself to heat very consistently so that you get these adaptive changes. And what you'll find is that throughout these sauna sessions, after a week or so, you tend to get way more comfortable, and you'll surpass thresholds where you would previously feel like you really had to get out of the sauna. You'll kind of meet that mark and be like, oh, I remember this part. You know, I remember when that used to be very, very difficult. And now I'm like, you know, zoned out completely. I'm not even really focused on my effort in here up until 5 minutes after that now. So
what happens with your GI system when you're on these long runs? Do you find that you still need to go to the bathroom the same amount, or how does that work? Are you finding yourself hungry? What do you eat?
Yeah. You know, I'm lucky that I haven't really had any stomach problems. So I guess I'm lucky in that sense. And I find it easiest in races to eat things that are familiar to you. A lot of people, you know, you could try these, like the sports sugar supplements, like the goo, like the gels and things like that. These, they have like sachets of, different components of, it's like maltodextrin powder with water and some fructose. They're essentially simple sugars that are easy to digest is the thought, and they work in, you know, a more timely manner. Once you consume them, they'll get into your bloodstream quicker. But I find for these longer events, one of the enjoyable parts is coming up to an aid station with a like wide variety of snacks, and you can kind of just look at the layout and just find something that looks good to you and eat it. And I think that for a lot of people starting out is a really good way of going about nutrition, because in the end, the goal is just to keep eating and not to be dependent on something that you're like very tired of eating. And you can get palate fatigue with some of those gels where you just can't stand to eat another one. And that's not a situation you want to be in, because ultimately you're in these events, your body needs fuel. So just finding fuel any way you can get it, you know, whether it's something sweet or salty, just finding something that sounds good to you at the moment and keeping your palate moving.
In a really long race, I imagine you've been doing essentially the same thing for a very long time. How do you manage the mental fatigue and stress of being in these extremely long events?
Yeah, you know, that's a really good question. I think that, you know, with training, to be honest, the difficulty and the time component, it actually just extends everything out further. So in a sense, you're chasing the dragon of that difficulty even further every time. So for instance, the last race I did, I had one of the best, you know, training like blocks going into it. I had really great training. I had a lot of really great guidance from friends and things. And I remember going into that race, I actually didn't feel any difficulty until around like mile 70. Like it felt very comfortable, and I just felt great. you know, to be honest, I didn't have any issues. Like the weather was like relatively good. It was kind of hot during the day, but I had done a lot of heat training. So overall, you know, I felt very, very good up through mile 70. And when it gets difficult, I really just more appreciate it. I find a way to appreciate it because you had to run 70 miles for it to get difficult, you know, and that's something you worked really hard to feel. So I don't really dread it at all. I think that, like, you know, you find out how deep your well is in a sense whenever you get to that moment and you get some difficulty from it. The component of like kind of like getting stressed out during a race is a lot of times if the weather changes, you know, if you're dealing with things that you kind of didn't anticipate during the race, like, you think the race is going to be hard, but when it starts thunderstorming and things get really muddy, there are ways to deal with, you know, stress or like, you know, some like negative mental aspects during a race. One of the big things with that I learned from Harvey Lewis is to kind of reframe or just really focus on what you can control. And I think that again has a lot of overlap with anesthesia. You know, if you get into a critical situation, we have like protocols already in place. We have a plan of how we're going to do it. And you really just focus on that. You're not really focused on, you know, something not going well.
If all else fails, do chest compressions.
Exactly. Yeah. There's always a plan B, C, and D. So that's really helpful in that sense. Is I really just focused on what I can control. The one race I did that had a lot of mud, and you know, as a runner, that's one of the most dreaded things because you do a lot of training and you do a lot of running, and then if you get to a race and you have to walk through mud for like 8 hours, it's like you know, you start to really think like, I didn't come out here to walk through mud for 8 hours. But I kind of, you know, you can reframe it and, you know, think, well, you know, it's muddy for everybody and it's everybody's wet and it's raining on everybody. So it's not a problem that's unique to you. And with the mud, you know, if you just keep going, it gets better. And that race in particular, it rained again and there's like puddles that formed. And the puddles actually helped you clean the mud off of yourself a little bit. And it actually made the mud less sticky. So as much as everybody was frustrated about the additional rain, it actually made the course better, you know, in a sense. So yeah, I just try to focus on what I can control. And in that sense, like, am I getting blisters because of this mud? Like maybe I need to do extra management with my feet or my shoes to help manage it. Or maybe I need to, you know, change, you know, clothes a little bit more often, or prepare, you know, try to wipe some of the mud off your legs if you're starting to get like, you know, friction or rubbing around like your shorts and stuff like that.
So what's the next big race that you're planning to do?
So the plan right now, the very next one is going to be in just about a month, I think. So in December, there's a race called the Dreadmill. And it's a treadmill race. So it's, I'm sure everybody's done this, but
you're going to have to explain a treadmill race is.
Yeah. So it's a race it's 48 hours on a treadmill. And the goal is just to go as far as you can. So, yeah. So it's pretty easy.
I'm pretty sure the Geneva Convention has outlawed what you're talking about.
Yeah, it might be a war crime. You're right. Yeah. The Dreadmill, I did it last year. It's actually a really fun race because there's people who you know that might not run or might not run your pace, but they can come over and hang out with you the whole time you're doing it, you know, and you can be right next to them. So it adds like a lot of layers. Like that's the fun thing about these races is that there's different formats and there's always like a different layer that makes it a little bit more interesting or a little bit more fun. While like, you know, a lot of these races are very solo, you know, the community around them is really good. So almost every race I've made 2 to 3 friends that I talk to regularly, you know, and like the network has grown so much just because of the community. And I think people knowing like the consistency and the training it takes, you kind of find solidarity in that. And one of my first races, I met a friend that I now use their treadmill for this treadmill race, and we kind of do it together, and it's been a lot of fun.
So do you have any rituals that you will do before a race or after a race?
Yeah, I think the lead up to a race can be, it's different for everybody, but a lot of people mention if they really taper their training, it's strange, but you can kind of get a little bit irritable from not running as much. It's just a strange phenomena, I think. It's like maybe you're not getting the outlet, or maybe you have like this extra energy that's kind of given off an irritability, or, you know, it's really hard to describe. I don't find that I'm like super irritable, but I do feel like I have like some like energy that I can't really do anything with going into a race. So in addition to that, I also cut my caffeine. So I've completely stopped caffeine the week of a race to kind of make myself more sensitive to it. And basically going into a race, that last day or so of prep can be very like stressful and frustrating, I guess, because you're doing a lot of stuff for the race, but it's not running, you know, and it can be a little hectic sometimes where you kind of just want to be done with all that background stuff and just start running in the race. So I think the biggest thing that I do is I plan in that I'm going to have everything done by a certain time and truly have like a window of time where I do like nothing, where I can just relax and not have to do anything else for the race. And just that way I'm able to say everything is done. Like everything's been checked and double checked and I have everything I need. And most importantly, my ritual is try to go to bed early. You know, a lot of the races, either the commute to the race or the race itself will start early in the morning. And, you know, if you're doing a race that's going to go for 24 hours or more, you know, sometimes 30 plus hours or sometimes days, then you really want to start that off with a good night of sleep, you know. And but I think that as a ritual is given me, you know, I think success so far in terms of feeling tired during a race.
So lastly, what style points or points of personal preference have helped you both in and out of the operating room or both on and off of the race course?
I think being consistent in some kind of exercise is super important. You know, I kind of talked when I first, you know, did my introduction, I talked about this circuitous path to ultra running. And, you know, when I look back at that, I realized that it's really just like a legacy of just like physical activity. Like, you know, that's kind of what it's chalked up to. It's not really, you know, it's just my personal story of just being physically active. And it doesn't have to be, you know, one specific thing. You can always like change out of, you know, different things that you're into at the time, but in the end it's all physical activity. And I think that having some component of that, even if it changes over the years, is super important to your professional life. I think it's a great work-life balance. It's a great like stress reliever. It keeps you healthy, you know, like weight-bearing exercise, and just, you know, helps you age better. And you have a much better quality of life for much longer.
That's really neat. I appreciate that. And I have one last question for you. Do you feel like you're running towards something or away from something?
Oh man, that's a good question. It depends. You know, I, yeah, so you asked me a question earlier about competition during, or about the last part of a race, you know, the last 80 miles or when you get to mile 80 of a race. And, you know, a big part of that is the competition at that point, you know, in the beginning of a 100-mile race, mile one, for me personally, I'm not super concerned about the competition or really looking at the competition. But around mile 80, it can be a big motivator. And in those cases, you do feel like you're both chasing somebody and you're running away from somebody. So that's kind of the fun of the race, is that like there's a lot of camaraderie. Like your competition will be like offering you water, like offering you help at the same time as like you're racing them. And it's you know, that's all part of like the fun culture of ultra marathons.
Jordan, thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Thanks for joining us for yet another episode of the award-winning Style Points podcast. What award, you ask? That would be the award for the best anesthesiology-themed long-form interview-style podcast at the University of Cincinnati, which I am proud to have won and also conceived of. Congratulations. If you would like to help us win additional awards, please feel free to give us a 5-star rating or write a brief review. This is what really helps other people find the podcast. You can also email us at stylepointspodcast@gmail.com. Well, we have reached the end of the marathon, everyone. Take a deep breath. Open your eyes. We're all done.